All right. What do you say we have a little bit of time to do questions and answers at some point? So what I might do is just do about a little less time of talking. And if you've got a question and you feel like I don't want to ask that in front of everybody, you can just write it down on a card and just set it up here, or just hand it in. I'm also going to give you the opportunity if you have a question or a disagreement or you want to think about how do we do this practically, some of these things that we're talking about, I'll be more than happy to kind of address those things with you, and we'll maybe do that in just a few minutes. To finish up the talk on humility, humility would just be to talk a little bit about the idea of vulnerability. For a group to kind of move toward some level of intimacy, there's got to be vulnerability. I often wonder why God tells his story the way he does. Every year at Easter, during Passion Week, I'm always amazed by the way God told the story. And you see Jesus humiliated, and you see Jesus mocked and beaten, and you see the imagery of him on the cross. I actually have a theory that, don't split a church over it. It's extra biblical. I mean, I've got kind of three theological categories: something I'd take a bullet for, something I think is important, and then something that's just interesting that may not even matter. And, I've often thought why God would darken the earth while Jesus was on the cross in the last stages of that time. Here's the Cofield theory, which is literally the third category, doesn't really matter. Who knows? It might not be true. It probably isn't. But it was Jesus, as God tells that story, that narrative of the Passion Week and the crucifixion, there is a way in which the God of the universe that has nothing to be vulnerable about, I mean, God's God, chooses to show himself as vulnerable. Because vulnerability invites relationship, and vulnerability invites connection. And so when I think of why would he have done that? I mean, why? I mean, there just had to be a sacrifice for the. It could have been done so differently, but he instead chose to tell the story with a level of vulnerability that is disarming. And there's a sense: how could God allow his? How can the Creator allow the creatures to treat him such? And I would suggest to you that there's probably more reasons than we can possibly imagine. It's God's story, not ours. This does become ours. I think it is that God was telling the story in a way that put him vulnerable, because vulnerability draws you in, and vulnerability invites relationship. So vulnerability is a pretty important thing. Vulnerability is not the same thing as weakness. Vulnerability is not the same thing as dumping everything you think and feel on another person. It's interesting, women want men that are vulnerable, but they don't want weak men. They don't want needy men. You want to turn off a woman in a second, be a needy man. And yet, vulnerability will draw them to you. That's kind of interesting. As a man, I go, I think, aren't those the same thing? And needy and vulnerable, same thing? And no, it's not. There's a strength in vulnerability that has to do with honesty. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about vulnerability in your groups. Someone, and it may need to be you, first of all, when you think about vulnerability in a group, think in terms of going one step deeper, one step further. Okay. Thank you. When you think about vulnerability, you don't want to go to the deep end in a group too quickly. That doesn't make sense. But one of the things you want to do as a facilitator is you want to push the group one step further than wherever it is. And so you're always looking for an opportunity to kind of go a step deeper, to be a little more engaging about, and often that will take vulnerability. Describing something, and sometimes it's required on your part to be vulnerable. But I'd like to talk a little bit about vulnerability from a perspective. How do you deal with vulnerability in small groups? You need to ask the question, is this my story to share? It's not vulnerable to tell somebody else's vulnerable story. It is sometimes informative, it's sometimes helpful, but if the story, and it really did surprise me, and in some ways it was a little embarrassing, to be honest with you, but the story about Morris Bagwell, that's not your story to tell. I mean, and if you told that story, you'd be like, hey, I know a guy who remembered that thing, and then, but it's not you being vulnerable. And so the first question, sometimes what we'll do is we'll tell another person's story because that is easier than our own. So first, ask the story, is this story your story? Second, am I using vulnerability or am I being vulnerable? And what do I mean by that? We are capable of manipulating people at an incredible level. I've never had a pure motive in my life, neither have you. We ended the last session talking about the dignity of our design. The depravity is incredible. I have seen my son Skyler use his autism to get toys. I mean, that's amazing. We are capable of, and so there's a difference between vulnerability, to share vulnerability, to help take a group deeper, and using vulnerability to manipulate other people. At some level, you always have that choice in every interaction you have. Am I going to manipulate someone to meet my needs, or am I going to minister to people to meet theirs? And you need to ask that question when you're telling a story as a group leader. Am I really just trying to get them to like me? Am I trying to get them to notice me? Am I trying to, and you don't ever have to have pure motives, you never will, but there has to be a sense of, am I using vulnerability or am I being vulnerable? There's a difference. You don't want to be someone that sees vulnerability as a technique. In my field, there's a lot of people that talk about healing prayer as a way of doing counseling, and I get that. I mean, I think we ought to be praying, but sometimes the way I hear it presented, it feels like they're using prayer as a technique. And prayer is how you commune with God. It's not a formula that you plug something into. It's a difference between using something and being something. So know the difference between am I using vulnerability or am I being vulnerable? Consider it. Is it safe? Is it spirit prompted for you to share? Now, remember, that doesn't mean comfortable. We kind of do it the wrong way. People say, well, I'm not going to share unless it's safe. Well, you don't really know it's safe until you share. You know what I mean? There's a way in which comes first. But and that's why you have to probably sometimes be the person to share a little more. But don't share the deepest secret. Don't start your first community group and say, well, you know, I never told anybody this, but, you know, I was born on Mars and I'm an alien. I mean, you know, don't start your group with that. But consider what the text is, consider what you're studying, and think about what's one thing I might share that would move us one step deeper. If you ever get somebody who's too quick of sharer, that's a person who's struggling. And as a good leader, one of the things when somebody overshares, you know what I mean by that? First group, you want to compliment their sharing and say, boy, I hope this group someday is strong enough and loves you well enough to be able to hold that story. You know, and kind of pull it back just a little bit and bring, and then get with them individually and say, boy, I appreciate you talked about the fact that you were sexually abused in our group the first night. That tells me there's, for you to share something that personal so quickly, it tells me there's probably not a lot of places that you're sharing. But you'll want to pull that one back just a little bit. If that were the first week. Now, if that was after people had gotten progressively a little more honest as time goes on. So is it safe? That doesn't mean comfortable. Matter of fact, rarely are we comfortable. Consider if you're hiding in your words or details. In terms of that, one rule of thumb I would say is, as a leader, you should never be sharing something with your group that you've never shared with another person first. Why? Well, because that means they're now becoming your group to take care of you. Now, I don't think that means you only share stuff that's finished or that doesn't prompt emotion. But if you come up with an insight about something very deep and personal in your life, the first time it's shared should not be to a group of people that you're in charge of shepherding. It's just not wise, because they won't, you shouldn't require them to be taking care of you. You're their shepherd. Does that make sense? So, do you need to be vulnerable? Sure. And vulnerability at this point, vulnerability at this point means that I'm sharing something that's true, that is, but I'm not going to share something with a group that I'm in charge of dealing with. Like, I won't bring it up again, but I was surprised by my emotion with Morris. I have shared that before, I just haven't shared it very often. And in my notes, when it said, after looking at the passage, give an example of coming alongside, I said, oh, tell about Morris Magwell. That's all I put in my notes. And so the emotion that showed up was real. But that's not the first time I've ever shared that. And that's not the first time that, and my wife knows that story. And it was a little bit vulnerable to me, but it wasn't new insight to me. Do you understand the difference? So it was real. It was surprising. However, it wasn't the first time I thought, you know, Jesus showed up that day with Morris. Now, sometimes you might be surprised by some insight and that sort of stuff, but basically, if you're the leader of the group, it doesn't have to be finished. It's okay for there to be still emotion. It's okay to be in process, but your group that you're a shepherd from should not feel like they have to take care of you. And that's why it's a good idea for you to have your own group that you're being taken care of, or that you're kind of taking care of yourself in the process. Because as a leader, as a shepherd, you almost want to appear as if you're just a peer. But you're not. Jesus looks you in the eye at some point, acknowledging your own failure and shame, and says, feed my sheep. And you've been kind of given that role, and that does not mean that you're supposed to turn that on them. Now, will there be times they'll minister to you? Yeah. The last small group I led and was in, it was in Orlando. We're getting ready to start a small group in our home again, but when Skylar was in the hospital, they all showed up. Did they minister to us? Yeah. But primarily, I did not see them as the place where my needs would be met. I saw them as the group that I was a shepherd for. Does it make sense? So Vulnerability, I think I don't need to tell you what vulnerability is, I guess, other than the fact that it's being honest about your own life and struggles and realities. You share it when people, and when you share those sort of things, people get closer to you. And it invites closeness. But you need to make sure that you're not manipulating people with it, and you make sure that you're not using it. Just kind of some rules of thumb in terms of vulnerability in your group. None of you mentor, this isn't youth. You don't minister youth. This is adults. Okay, so there's some further guidelines I'd have about being vulnerable if you were working with student groups, because I think that's got an extra dynamic, but in terms of vulnerability. Because they'll go back and whatever you were vulnerable about, they'll tell their parents that, you know, the youth leader said that they took drugs in high school. And that sometimes doesn't go well. So that's the end of our kind of, that's kind of the information that I was going to go with about being humble. The only other thing in my notes is Galatians 6, 1 and 2, which is an incredible passage that basically says this. This is a rough version of that. Hey, those of you that are caught up in sin, those of you that are spiritual, your job is to restore people who are caught up in sin, but do it gently lest you also fail. Powerful, powerful passage. It suggests that all of us, once you know Jesus, are going to be in one of two categories at all times. You're either going to be faithful at the moment, or you're going to be stumbling at the moment. If you're faithful at the moment, then your job is to have a ministry of restoration in another person's life. The word restore that's used there in the Greek is the same word that's used when the disciples are mending their nets to make them useful again. It's the idea that to restore it back to use. But the implication is that those are pretty dynamic groups. The spiritual people and the people caught up in sin are pretty dynamic groups that you switch in and out of. And so therefore you're supposed to do it humbly and gently, lest you also fail. The implication being that that's how you're supposed to do it. So that's kind of my conclusion on the humility. Yes? Galatians 6, 1 and 2. That whole section is really beautiful. All right, so that is, talk 2 is over at the beginning of talk 3. This would be a fine time to take questions. Anybody? So we've got two talks out of the way. We've talked about curiosity, and we've talked about humility. What would be anything helpful? Any conversations that you want to have about this?
I'll give you a scenario and give you some guidance on it. Oftentimes, when someone is vulnerable, either personally and you share a story, or someone in your group shares a story, there's oftentimes a tendency for either the person who's listening to that story or someone in the group to instantly start to tell their story. Right on top of when somebody is vulnerable. As an example, real life here, family, we just kind of put a pet down. So that's a big deal. We put our dog down, very personal. And I've experienced when I've told that story, almost instantly I get interrupted. And then they want to tell their story with no regard for my story. So as a group leader, I've seen that happen dynamically. Someone starts to tell their story, they're very vulnerable, and the response from the group is not necessarily absorbing that story, allowing that person to continue being vulnerable, but to reflect back on their own personal story, which is very similar to theirs. And I would love to get your perspective on how do we work with that.
Well, great question. Your best guess, why do you think people do that? Why would the people, when they see a strong leader like yourself, elder in the church, say, boy, we put our dog down, and it was devastating. Why do you think that they typically go, well, you know, I put little Porky down 2 years ago. Why do you think they do that?
I'm not going to answer the question. I'd like to hear
another question. Well, why do you think people are so quick to do that? I think there can be a good reason for it and a bad reason for it. The good reason for it is they're connecting with that story. They're having a mood congruent memory, if you will. They're remembering. What's a bad reason for it?
I'm worse.
It can be competitive. it also can be, I don't want to sit in your pain. I don't want to sit in your pain because let's move on. And you know, we got over it. We got over it when we did this. And so if you're a leader, when that happens, be aware that there's probably multiple reasons it's taking place.
One-on-one's a little different in the group. It's more for the group here and the group dynamic of a small group.
Well, this, yes.
If you want to answer, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Okay.
We've got a situation in our group where, there's a person that comes that, feels like they have the answers to people's problems. And I feel like this person really needs to, they're pretty sure about what they think, but they can certainly use the gospel because they don't think the person's a believer. And it's difficult to manage that because they're pretty sure about a great solution for sort of every problem, and yet they need to be ministered to, and I don't think they're really at a place where, like, an example of vulnerability isn't going to sort of make an impact on this person. And so we want them to be there, but at the same time, it's difficult for that person to be there.
Well, yeah, let me give you a couple of ways to really think about that. Usually when you have, and this is going to get into our fourth lecture, but it's okay, this is important. Usually when you have somebody who is doing something in the group that's bothersome, you want more of them, not less of them, in one sense. I mean, I just don't want them hiding behind their solutions. I don't want them to hide behind the fact that they've got another story. Let's use yours and then we'll talk about yours. You know, I think if I were the leader of that group and you had just shared the story and there's, your eyes are soft and then somebody quickly says, well, you know, last year we put down 7 dogs. I think you're one to help, but instead, could we just camp just a little bit longer with that story? Because I think, ultimately, living on this side of heaven is about loss, and I think we could learn something about what he's talking about with loss. And I'd pull it back to you. I'd tip my hat to the person who interrupted, but then I'd come back and say, I'm going to assume a good motive of theirs, even though it probably isn't. You know, I mean, it probably is not malice. They're probably not doing it out of malice, because I deal with malice probably differently. It's probably just, they're probably just being either selfish or they're just not willing to sit in your pain. And so I'm going to tip my hat to them and say, boy, I appreciate the fact that you've experienced something similar. But before, I know, and we want to hear about that in a few minutes, but could we go back to Mike? It's Mike, right?
Yeah.
Could we go back to Mike? Mike, that sounds like a really difficult story. Tell us more about that, your dog. How long had you had the dog? And re-invite that, and that way you've kind of tipped a hat to the fact that you probably were trying to just help. There wasn't malice in what you just did, but I'm going to shut that down and I'm going to come back here. But then after it feels like you've kind of done that, you just took us to a deeper level and I'm going to stir it. And now because he said something, I'll probably stir it to him first and I'll go, wow, Mike, is there anything else you need to say about that? Because that seems like that was such an important thing. We've given you more time. And then you go, well, Ed, you were talking about how that had happened to you. How has everybody else here dealt with loss? And now I've stirred it. I've acknowledged that person who came in. But I didn't discount you. Now, when you've got the person who's trying to solve everybody's problem, it depends how long they've been coming. If they've been coming a long time, I would say, I think your heart is really to help us. And I really appreciate it, but why don't we get some feedback? Mike, was that very helpful for you when Bob, whatever the guy's name is, kind of gave you the solution. And if the person's, if the group is honest enough, the groups have, if you've kind of gone down a little bit, that person will say, well, not really. And I said, okay, so Bob.
Or they say nothing at all.
Yeah, so Bob, your heart, I wish we all had the same, the heart that wants to solve it. But it sounds like at this moment, we need to sit in this instead of solve it for just a little while. And now, again, what I've done is I've honored, I'm going to assume a good intent. I've honored the intent of the heart, but I've shut it down. Now, now it will be different if I felt like it was out of malice. I guess the point of this next lecture kind of fits this, and that's that a group becomes a microcosm of what is going on in their regular life. And so if somebody is dominating your group, they're dominating their family too. If you feel kind of creepy around somebody, chances are other people feel creepy around them too. And that's helpful to know because you're the shepherd or the shepherd's assistant. And so what I sometimes will tell students is you need to develop 3 years. And I'm not going back to lecture. We're still talking questions. But you develop 3 years. The first year, you can get a PhD in counseling and just develop 1 year, and that's the listening year. You know, and there's a lot of programs that all you'll listen, all you'll hear is how to be an active listener and listen, and you know, and that's helpful. And you can help people by being a good listener. You know, what I hear you saying is that you're saying that you're hearing me say that, you know, and that's good. I mean, that's good listening. That's developing 1 year. Second year you want to develop, if you're going to be a good counselor or shepherd, is you want to develop an ear for what is God up to? What's the bigger story? We're going to be talking about story in a little bit. What's the bigger story that fits the story of redemption? What would happen if this was a redeemed situation? What would happen if this wasn't the end of the story? What would happen if there's another chapter to be written? Now that's kind of, you know, what might God be up to in the middle of this? But the third ear you want to develop is the ear to listen to your gut feeling about a person. And it's what I call, and I'm sure I stole this from somebody, the pull. Everybody has a pull. Have you ever heard that phrase? Anybody ever heard that phrase? People have a pull? Where have y'all heard that? Do you know? Yeah, there's some counseling people that kind of talk about that and they'll use that phrase. Sometimes people will say, people that have had more education than they need will sometimes say that everybody has a projective identification, which is the same thing, which means they're projecting something of their identity into all situations. But haven't you met somebody that when you, I mean, you're with them for like 30 seconds and they feel needy to you and you're kind of going, holy cow, there is more they need than I got. I mean, you know, you just feel that. You just kind of feel that. Sticky, you know, that kind of deal, right? And aren't there some people that you kind of feel like they've got power? And it's like, and when you're with them, you kind of go, okay, I better do this right. I better, you know, I better clean it up. I better do it right. That's their pull. There's some people who can have a pull of ingratiation, like, you owe me. Some people have a kind of a hero's pull, like, admire me. You know, and some people kind of have a sexy pull, you know, and that's that kind of, you know, and when you're with them, there's this kind of sense of, and it's not necessarily, it's not like that they're wearing bad, you know, the wrong clothes or something, but it's almost like, I could rock your world. You know, I mean, and that would be your pull. That's we all know that. That's true. We didn't mean to.
She wouldn't piss bump me.
You know. We didn't mean to point it out, but that's the whole reason we've come to this. We're not really here about a community groups. This is an intervention. But everybody has a pull. And you need to learn to read that pull. Because if you feel it, other people feel it. And so if somebody has that pull of, I'm the fix-it man. And it's kind of an annoying fix-it man, because he's seeing people as mechanical beings, not relational beings. Because ultimately, we're not relational beings, we're not mechanical beings that need to be fixed. We are relational beings with realities that must be faced. And so your friend doesn't see it that way. He sees it as, I'm going to fix you. But if you feel that, the whole group feels that. And so what would be gracious to him, though very difficult to offer, is to hold up a mirror and let him see that. And so you want to think about, how can I do that? How can I do that with grace and humility? Not with an arrogance that says, you know, you annoy the crap out of everybody in here. I mean, but how can I? Because essentially, I love your heart. You want to fix us. You want to help us. But what you're doing really isn't helping. Could we talk more about what Mike might need right now from you instead of what you've offered? Because your heart really wants to offer something. And that way, does that make sense? And so when you engage somebody, it's really funny, and now we're into like lecture four, so we've completely blown this whole thing up. But what you really want to, you want to hold up a mirror at some level that lets people see, and that's why I said, that's why we talk about humility before we talk about this. Because if you don't have humility when you do this, you found real arrogant. You annoy me. And you annoy all of us. I mean, that's not helpful. Be aware, if I were to do a personality test, instead of the Enneagram or the DISC or the Aardvark and Golden Retriever or whatever that one is, or I think I would look at the three seats of Christ, prophet, priest, and king, and most people tend to be one or the other of those. A prophet kind of says, you hate your mother, you've always had your mother, now quit. You know, their prophet is the priest comes alongside, the king likes to teach. And you need to figure out which one of those you are, because you're supposed to be a combination of all three of those as you lead as Christ leads. And what we tend to do is we tend to, whatever we do, we think that's the right way and we strengthen it. I don't know if any of you work out. I mean, obviously I do. But the two or three times I've been in a gym in my life, I've noticed what's always kind of funny to me is it seems like the people are working on the part of their body that's already good. So the guy who's got an arm the size of a canned ham, you know, and he's just, you know, and his legs look like my legs, you know, just kind of just there. And, you know, and he's sitting there looking in the mirror and spending like an hour and a half working on this muscle. And I'm going, maybe that's why it's so big, but, you know, maybe if you'd work on the rest of your body, it wouldn't be so awkward. But it seems like we tend to do that. We tend to, whatever our strength is, that we kind of, okay, I need to develop that. So the priest learns new ways to tell everybody what they need to know. And the king, you know, wants to carry a whiteboard with him and wherever they go and teach everywhere. And the priest is going, well, how do you feel about how you feel? And there's a way in which whichever you are, that's great. But you want to develop those other two voices. Does that make sense? So if any of you want to do a personality test based on that, that'd be great. Just give me a little bit of credit. And we'll be rich together. Any other questions? Those were great questions. Yes. Wow, that's a great question. Any other questions? I guess it's the intent is whether it's about you or about them. I mean, I'm using vulnerability if it's about me. I'm not using vulnerability if it's ultimately to serve another. And so I guess that's such a good question, because so much of our sin, no one but Christ knows. Because the intent of our hearts are different. That might look the same. I mean, to say, I was really kind of nervous today about, well, there's a little bit of vulnerability. I kind of pushed it. And only Christ and I will know whether that was to manipulate or to minister. And so that's why...
Can I piggyback on that? What if your motive isn't pure? I mean, rarely our motives are pure. So do we just keep our mouths shut forever? Or how do we still move forward for our group?
You have a delightful smile, by the way. So you have a delightful smile. I think you start with the idea, I'll never get 100%. I'll never be 100%. Am I over 50%? Am I kind of, is most of me not wanting to manipulate here? Is most of me wanting to minister? And that's about all you'll do. I mean, you'll never have a pure motive. I mean, I've been in the middle of preaching before and thought, I'm really doing really good today. You know, and it's like, I mean, and I'm still in the middle of the sermon, you know, and I'm going, I'm just really knocking it out of the park. And it's like, what? What? This isn't even, what am I doing? And it's like, where does that come from? You know? And so it's so such a good question. But I think the best you can do is be honest with God and just kind of stumble past 50%. Say, Lord, to the best of my knowledge, I really want this to be something that is helpful to them and not about me. I acknowledge to you that some of it may be about me, but my best attempt is that. And that's a great question. Anybody else? Any other questions?
I think I would just say being intentional about what you're going to share during the prayer. Because most of us have the time when we go around and talk about what's going on in prayer requests. Which there's space to think about that.
You know, and that's such a good point, because I think one of the places where vulnerability, you can start modeling vulnerability in an early group, is with prayer requests. And you know what I meant. I used the example last night. An early group that is still wagon wheeling, hasn't done any hard work yet, you can always tell it by the prayer requests. Their prayer requests will be always other-centered, usually about somebody's health, and often about somebody who's not in the group. So, you're talking about some other person doing that. And so that's a great idea, a great way to say, and again, I'm not using prayer the way I would think about that is the idea that, gosh, if we really stopped and prayed, even if in this room, if we really had a prayer time where you were honest about God, about what's going on in your personal life right now, it would be very vulnerable. I mean, it'd be very personal. And so we'll probably never get quite that deep. But, you know, how can I move one step further? And that's going to be a time where, you know, it can be. Yes. Yeah, I think it's great. I think that, you mind if I sit while we have questions? Is that okay? I think one of the dynamics that makes church groups harder than therapy groups is usually therapy groups become closed. And so what happens is you develop this process. You kind of go from the wagon wheel to the spokes. You've kind of had a pushback time. They started to develop their own personality, and then there's a kind of a closed group, and so they're going to agree to meet 12 times or 15 times, and they're a closed group. The problem with the way that we do groups, the good thing about it is that we're always welcoming someone. The bad news is that you have to almost reinvent it pretty regularly, and so... it's not a bad idea to have a couple of group guidelines when somebody's new. You kind of go over those. Like one of those, I mean, the group guidelines ought to be about, there ought to be something even in church groups about confidentiality and gossiping. Confidentiality is just a psychological word to talk about the biblical concept of gossip. I mean, it's same idea. And so there probably ought to be a rule for your groups about about confidentiality. You know, they say, hey, what do we say here? You know, that we need to be really mindful of that. We're not a group that gossips, or maybe a, you know, you could go as far as a group gets older to kind of put some rules in play, like, hey, that you don't be too quick to solve somebody else's problem. And actually make that part of the culture of the group. But, for people to put up with the annoyance of another human being, you have to know their story well enough remember I said we're teleological beings. There's a reason we do what we do. And you can have a whole lot more patience when you know what that reason is for somebody. Like my wife, she hates to be late. I mean, she just hates to be late. And she married me. And I hate to come early because I don't know what to do. I think it's bad use. It's not being a good steward of my time. I mean, I could use my time studying or getting ready or read one more chapter or do something. So if I had to be there at 3 o'clock, I'll be there, pretty close to 3 o'clock. But, you know, why would I waste my time and get there early? Well, you know, for years, I would just annoy the stew out of my wife. And I would just say, okay, we missed the call to worship, but we got the rest of the service. Or, so we missed the movies, the previews of the other movies, but we saw the whole movie, and then one day I just got curious, and this is where we go back to curiosity. And the reason my wife hates to be late is not because she's crazy and I'm right, or I'm crazy and she's right. It's because she was a little girl. She grew up in Rockwood, Tennessee. That's why we moved back to Tennessee, is because she grew up in East Tennessee, and that's home for her. She grew up in a very poor family. There were two girls, and the two girls were asked to go to church every Sunday, but the rest of the family didn't go. And so every Sunday morning, my wife and her sister, Luanna, were taken in their beat up, her dad's, Frank's beat up old car in dresses that aren't as nice as the other kids to First Baptist Church, Rockwood, Tennessee. And usually they were taken there a little bit late. And if you know anything about Baptist churches, which for a minute last night I thought maybe y'all were Baptist because everybody was sitting in the back, I'm just saying. But Baptist Church in East Tennessee, when you get there early so you can sit in the back. And what's left over after the service has started is the front few rows. So every Sunday morning, Mona and her sister Luanna, in dresses not quite as nice as everybody else, were, by the nice deacon and usher, were brought down front, put in that front row. And I don't know when she did it, probably sometime when she was 7 or 8 years old, but there was a day when she was walking down that aisle and she said, "When it's up to me, I will never, ever, ever be late again." Now, what's that got to do with one of the things that has to happen in a group is people need to know each other's story well enough so that when somebody annoys you, you know their story enough to have grace for them. And so there has to be some sense when a new person comes of, let's try to do something. And that's why, to get to know each other, that's why probably the beginning of every group ought to have some relational connecting piece. Like, you know, we're going to be looking at the story of, we're going to look at the story today of Jesus and the wedding of Cana. If you're married, tell us where, if this was a couple that came in to say, hey, we're going to all go around and tell where you got married or where your parents got married or the funniest wedding story you've ever heard. Out of your life. And what you're doing is you're getting them to tell a little piece of their life. With the idea that each week, the more you know their story, the more you'll be able to understand them and the more you'll have patience and grace for them. But so that way a new person kind of connects. So when a new person comes in, I want to have something light enough at the beginning so they can get a sense of, so the group can get a sense of who they are and then get a sense of who the group is. If there's some rules, especially about any about confidentiality, I'm going to say what those rules are or the expectations of the group are, and then you know then just welcome them in. But it does take. It's almost like a bobber. You know, a group starts to get deeper, and then all of a sudden a new person comes in, it pops back up a little bit. And then, you know, you go and you start to get deeper, and then a new person comes in, you get it pop back up. But that's the way we don't want to close off our groups, because they're community groups, and, that's the way I would kind of think about that. Any other questions or any thoughts? Was that helpful, or is that? Well, like, you all know each other for the most part, but that little activity last night was really an activity to kind of tell each other a little bit of your story. Because I can put up with a lot if I know your story. The goal.
I was at a community group, and you had a new person, and you kind of went around and you did like something there about like.
Well, don't start. Make sure you don't start with that person and say, "All right, we'd like to share stories about when we were ever bitten by a dog." Anybody? Well, you go first. But you want to and try to have it something that's not a yes or no question, or just like a, well, you know, when were you married, or when did you start school, or where do you work? Those would be what most people would call closed-end questions. You want to have an open-ended question at the beginning that's kind of invitational. And make sure that you all, and make sure as a leader, you're willing to do it first. So does that make sense? And it won't always work. People are always nervous. I required all the counseling students, I mean, I required all the MDiv students at RTS to go to an AA meeting. And it was one of my most fun things to do. I mean, I had, you know, these good Christian guys who were going to be pastors would say, well, it'll, no, can I tell? And I said, no, the only rule is you can't go with anybody else. And you can't tell people you're there to observe. You just go in, sit down, see a meeting and leave, and then write it up. And what they would tell, they'd tell you every time, and I said, and I told them what to expect. I said, the group's going to go around, and then it'll get to you. Say, you know, my name's Jim Cofield, and I'm here just, I'm just checking things out, or I'm just here to observe today, or this is my first time coming. As soon as they realize it's your first time, the entire group will change. They'll immediately turn it into what they would call a first step group, which is admitting you're an alcoholic. And, and so all these good, you know, MDiv students that are kind of going, I can't believe he's making me go to an AA meeting, would all of a sudden be loved on by all these recovering alcoholics saying, I remember when I first came, I couldn't admit I was an alcoholic, but I'll never forget my first meeting, how nervous I was. And it was beautiful. And you don't know how many papers I got from MDiv students that said, why can't the church do this? Why can't we? I've never felt more welcomed and more cared for in my life. Why isn't the church doing this? I mean, I had paper after paper guys with their arms folded, I'm not going. I had one guy drive down to Fort Lauderdale, which is about 3 hours from Orlando, because he said he didn't want to hurt the name of Christ in Orlando. And I said, I think the name of Christ can do fine without worrying about you. But you know, he was just, But it was one of those things where I felt like they needed to experience that. It's that sort of deal. The group just comes around them. It's fascinating to watch. Any other questions? All right. The topic that we're going to spend a few minutes on, and literally just a few minutes on, is the idea of story. And it kind of fits with some of the things we're talking about. Remember I said that I want you to develop a third ear? Another way to say that is you want to listen for how a person narrates their story. Because that is ultimately their pull. And it's just helpful to know what how they tell their story. For example, you can tell your story like it's a tragedy. And a tragedy will that person will tell their story like they're a victim. And that's their narration. Now, I'll just give you a couple examples. And if I were to, I could talk about, say I was diagnosed with cancer. I don't mean to make light of that. I mean, I'm not at all. I mean, I realize that there are people in this room that's going on in their life right now, I'm sure, or somebody you know. And I'm not trying to be cavalier, but you could tell that story, I was diagnosed with cancer, as a victim. Can't believe it. Once again. Just feels like the wind's against me. And there's a time when that might be appropriate. You could tell that like you're a hero. I was diagnosed with cancer and I said to that doctor that this cancer has met a fighter and I am going to fight it like it's never been fought before. Now that's telling the same story from the voice of a hero. Now a victim wants to be taken care of. A hero wants to be admired. You could tell it like a clown in the story is a comedy. And how does a comic would tell it? And then a guy told me that I got cancer. I mean, and I eat vegetables all the time. You know, you could hear someone telling the story like it's a comedy. In a comedian. Yeah, a victim wants to be taken care of. A hero wants to be admired. There's really countless ways people tell their story. This is their pull. A clown wants to be liked. I used to tell my story. You see, you can still be funny, or maybe you don't think I'm funny, but I used to tell my whole story, my whole life, like I was a clown. And it was a comedy. But what was underneath that was a desperate sense of I want to be liked. And as I face that idolatry, I can still be funny, but I can also tell when the story is a different type of story, I can tell it in a different way. I can narrate it more vividly. But listen for how people narrate their story. A documentary. Have you ever heard somebody who said, well, diagnosed with cancer. It was just stage 3, and there's a lot of people that have a lot worse, and there's people that get cancer every day. I mean, people get cancer every day. We're just going to, put my head down, and I'll take the, we'll see what happens. And then, a documentary, you're not connected to the story. You're just a good documentary. They don't participate in the story. They just observe. I used to, in the developmental psych class I taught at RTS, I used to show a documentary about babies, the first year of their life. Anybody ever seen that documentary? It's really fascinating. They follow 4 babies for the first year of their life. One from Mongolia, one from Kenya, one from Tokyo, and one from San Francisco. And they just show the different cultures and the way the kids... Well, there's one scene where the kid in Mongolia is about to be eaten by a yak. I don't know what it is. Some dumb animal. I'll call it a yak. And so you're thinking... And you want to, and the camera doesn't move. It's like, and this little baby is kind of crawling out in a field with a yak, and it's like, and you want to go drop your camera, buddy. That's a baby. I mean, forget your little thing. You can get another picture later, but they're kind of, it's a documentary. We're filming. Oh, here comes the yak. I wonder what the yak's going to do with the baby. And you think, well, you should never ask that question. You know, never ask the question, what's a yak going to do with a baby? You just say, let's go get the baby. But it's that they tell it like a documentary. Well, we know people that kind of, they lose a spouse or they lose a child. And it's like, well, they're in heaven and we can trust God and everything's okay. And you want to go, yeah, that's true. That's a documentary. The facts are there, but there's not any connection. And so, listen, and I thought, you know, people can tell their story like they're, you know, kind of the sexy pull. They can tell their story like the ingratiation pull. They can tell. Everybody's got a different way of narrating the story, but we're all telling a story with our lives, and you need to become fascinated by story. A good counselor loves stories because God loves stories, because God's telling an amazing story of redemption. He's just telling an amazing story. And at some level, people who are stuck, the question that they're really asking is, does my story end here? And one of the beauties of the gospel is redemption. And redemption is not believing that bad is not bad. That's foolishness. That's silliness. Redemption is believing that bad is not the end of the story. When somebody says, that's the problem I have with some of the counseling techniques that kind of imagine Jesus is sitting there with you when you're being harmed. It's like, is that really, is it redemption somehow minimizing real pain, or is it redemptive to kind of say sexual abuse wasn't so bad because God's going to do something with it? No. Abuse is bad, always. It's evil. But redemption is, that's not where the story ends. Redemption is that somehow even the most broken of things can be somehow woven into a story that doesn't end in the sorrow. I mean, you think of the story of, Genesis. What's Genesis about? Creation, that's what all of us would say about creation. But the creation story is only about 4 chapters. You know who gets the bulk of it? About 16 chapters? I'll give you a hint. He is sold into slavery by his brothers.
Keep going.
So what's that story? That's a story that is, so in the middle of Genesis, you get this long story of it's good, it's bad, it's good, you know, a favored son, it's good, betrayed by your brothers, oh, it's bad. Oh, it doesn't end there. It's good. He gets saved from the pit. Oh, he's now a slave. Oh, it's bad. Oh, he gets favor. Up, he's, and the story goes back and forth. And how does it end? It ends with him saying, you meant it for evil. God meant it for good so that many could be saved. That's redemption. It doesn't mean that it wasn't bad. It doesn't mean that when he was betrayed, it didn't hurt him. It doesn't mean that it was horrible that he was thrown in a pit by his brothers. It doesn't mean that there wasn't pain and sorrow along the journey. It just means that the sorrow wasn't the last chapter of the story. And that's redemption. If you want a happy ending, you've got to be careful where you end a story. Because every good story stopped at the wrong place is a tragedy. And so sometimes what you're helping people do, because you want to love story, you're helping people realize that their story, it ultimately is falling God's grand narrative of creation, fall, redemption, restoration. Creation, fall, redemption, recreation. And in a way, your life will go through that one time. In another way, your life will go through that 1,000 times. It's a story that God tells. Every good story you love, the reason you love it is ultimately about redemption. Because good stories are, that's what God's story is about. That's why it connects with you. And so you need to, I just looked at my notes and they're upside down. I'm not sure what that means. You need to be somebody who loves story. Because people understand their lives in story form. They understand it in narrative form. And you've got to acknowledge that the Bible, at least a third of the Bible is narrative. Which is very disappointing to the good systematic theologians. It's like, you know, give me Romans. Don't give me the stories of the Old Testament. You know, because stories, narratives, a narrative is evocative. It's evoking something from you. That's why parables are evocative. A story is evocative. It evokes something from you. And so what you want to do is you need to love stories. When somebody begins to tell the story of their life, you need to say inside of you, what's being evoked in me? What's being evoked in me by their story? And if it's not, oh my goodness, God is a redeeming God, then it tells you there's something to work on in their story, in their life. How should a story be narrated? I mean, you know, there's thousands of different ways to narrate a story. I'll tell you the best hint I would see of how you should narrate a story is the Gospel of John. How does he narrate the Gospel? What does he call himself in his narrative? Yeah. And you read John and he says, and then the disciple that Jesus loved did this. And you want to go, John, we know it's you. We know you're writing about you. But you love it because it's like he's writing the gospel with the voice of, I know I'm loved. I know I'm a one that's loved. Now, I don't tell my story that way. I started out telling it as a clown. I then became more heroic in the way I tell my story. But as I grow in Christ, the story becomes, my voice, I want it to sound a little bit more like John's. I want to tell the story of my life as one who's loved, one who's beloved, one who's been given God's grace and blessing. That's how a healthy story is told. But we never start out with a healthy story. We always narrate it differently, and people will narrate it differently based on the past and based on their lives. And so you want to become an expert at reading story. And if somebody's ever in front of you and they're boring, with the exception of right now, then what you need to know is they're just not telling the truth, because God does not write boring stories. He doesn't. He's a great author. I mean, God is a great author. And if you're sitting with somebody and they're just kind of like, you know, vanilla, and you go, first of all, everybody else when they're around them thinks they're vanilla. But what you want to catch is the sense that they're telling a story, and you want to be caught up in, because God's telling a story and he's a great author. Does that make sense? All right, I'm going to look at the time and see how we're doing. Not too well, thank you. Hey, you know what's really kind of fascinating is I'm figuring this will be the last time I'll ever be invited here, but because I've not done really great with the time. But you have your questions were so worth our time. I will spend at the end of our time after lunch. We'll dismiss people when my time's up, but I'll sit here as long as you'd like and engage questions. I mean, if you want to stay longer, we'll deal with the questions as long as you want, because your questions were just so good. I just thought they were just great questions. And I want us to try to be real practical. I do want to cover some material too. So what we'll do is when we come back from lunch, I'll kind of hit it pretty hard with lecture on some things. I want to kind of cover some material. But I think I told enough about story that we're okay. And we'll, That's right. Just for tradition's sake, I should finish that. And then, but the last thing that I said that you need to have is courage. And we'll kind of talk about courage. And that's going to be dealing with difficult people. If we have time, we'll talk about depression, anxiety, where that comes from. So we kind of have a sense of that. And we'll also talk about people with personality disorders and what happens when they show up in your groups. And if we can get all that done in an hour, we'll have been going to the races. That's right. But I think that'll be helpful for you. I think that'll be really good to know those sort of things.